Welcome back to Here and There, the podcast of the Germanic American Institute. This is Günther. Before I send you into today's episode, I do have an announcement for you. For those particularly who are interested in getting a small and non-committal German experience, we have two online sampler classes called Schnupperkurse. These are coming up on March 31st and April 8th at 6:30 p.m. and will be done via Zoom from the comfort of your home. Tickets are only $10 and you can register on our new website, gaimn.org. Now, the Schnupperkurse are for listeners who are curious about taking a German class with the GAI, what it feels like, what this is all about, and then if you decide that this is the right fit for you and you sign up for a spring session class, you'll get the $10 off the course fee and, in addition, a free beverage voucher for a future GAI event. Now, really, nothing to lose here. To get on board, just log on to gaimn.org and register. Now, onward to the actual show. In today's episode, we are taking you back to a virtual talk about the denazification of Germany. This talk was originally broadcast via Zoom, and you can also find it on our YouTube channel. And to introduce you to the virtual talk and to the presentation itself with Professor David Tompkins, I'll hand it over to Erin Hart, our Director of Communications at the GAI.
I would like to welcome you all to today's virtual talk, Denazification and the Cold War, the United States and Germany after World War II. I am very happy to introduce our speaker, Professor David Tompkins. Professor Tompkins joins us from Carleton College, where he is Associate Professor of History, Director of the Center for Global and Regional Studies, and Director of European Studies. His career includes positions at the University of Tennessee and the College of Worcester, in addition to others in the United States and overseas. He completed his doctorate in modern European history from Columbia University, and he is particularly interested in the relationship between culture and politics. We are very delighted to have a scholar and historian of Professor Tompkins' caliber with us here today. This presentation is the final event of the GAI's Transatlantic Chapters series on pivotal moments in German and American history. This series included the exhibit, Stars and Stripes Over the Rhine, the American Occupation in Germany After World War I, and other expert speakers this fall. I encourage you all to look at our website to see links to the other events on our YouTube page. And now with that, I will turn the microphone over to our speaker for today, Professor Tompkins. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Erin, and thank you to the Germanic American Institute for inviting me to speak today. Thank you all for joining us tonight. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen with you. You are able to, if the little videos on the side of your screen are blocking some of the slide, if you hover over them, you can see on the top various options to reduce the thumbnail video entirely to nothing, or to just me, or to a smaller number of people, and you can even drag them around your screen so that hopefully you'll be able to see the entire slide that I'm showing. So what I'm going to talk about today, as you can see here, is the United States' relationship to Germany after the Second World War, and I'm particularly going to focus on the decade after the Second World War. But before I go there, I want to go backwards a little bit. I hope you've all had the chance to see the exhibit Stars and Stripes Over the Rhine, ideally in person. If not in person, there's a very good representation of the exhibit at the GAI's website, so you can virtually tour and see the various panels. I think there are 18 or 20 of them that give you a sense of this, in a sense, prelude to the talk that I'm going to give today. And I'd like to start off with some kind of comparative thoughts about the United States and Germany after World War I, and then again after World War II, and tie that into thinking a bit more about the German context in 1919 to 1923, and then again Germany in 1945 to 1955. And then I'll talk about this occupation after the Second World War, give you some of the nitty-gritty details, and then kind of zoom out a little bit, kind of give you a sense of what the Americans and the other allies were thinking at this time in the late years of the Second World War and in the immediate aftermath when they find themselves, happily from their perspective, having defeated Germany and Germany's unconditional surrender, and now what to do. So obviously discussions had been happening before May of 1945, but now really the rubber is meeting the road. They have to decide how to handle Germany, what to do about these Germans. And of course, one of the major initiatives was denazification. So I will spend a fair amount of the talk focusing on this particular concept, what the Americans were doing. I'll offer some brief comparative comments on what the other allies were doing, including the Soviet Union, and then transition to thinking about the Cold War through a German prism, talk about this post-World War II moment. These allies who had worked together to defeat Nazi Germany, now struggling to figure out how to handle a divided Germany. And of course, a Cold War is intensifying, you know, almost immediately after the end of the hot war of World War II. And just offer you a few thoughts about how Germans and Germany figure into this larger Cold War story. And then, of course, leave some time at the end for some questions. Okay, so the first point here, thinking about the contexts in the aftermath of these world wars of the 20th century. So if you've seen the exhibit, and again, I hope you have or will soon do so, the Americans had a very small occupation zone after the First World War. You can see on this map here the demilitarized zone of Germany after the First World War. The Americans, I don't know if my cursor comes through, but the Americans had this very small occupation zone. You'll see it on a map in the exhibit if you were to go to it. And I don't know if Aaron or somebody can actually drop the link to that in the chat if anybody wants to sort of nose around there after my talk or even during the talk. But a few key differences confront the Americans and their allies in the aftermath of World War II than was the case in World War I. And just to spend a few minutes thinking about Germany and the German context in 1918, and 1919 versus 1945. So the Germans in the at the end of the First World War and the immediate aftermath of the First World War, for many Germans, this came as an enormous shock that they had lost the First World War, the Great War, of course, as it was known at the time. If you think about how the war had gone down, you know, German troops were in Belgium and France still holding their positions, though being forced to retreat in the fall of 1918. But almost all of their troops were on foreign soil at the time of the armistice in November of 1918. If we go back a little bit to the Eastern Front, that is Germany's fight against Russia, the Germans had successfully knocked Russia out of the war in 1917. And had come to a peace, a very punitive peace towards what would become the Soviet Union in 1918. In March, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk took great swaths of territory from the Russians, imposed penalties on Russia. If you know some of the history of the First World War, of course, the great difficulty for Germany was fighting this war on two fronts and being forced to face Russia in the east, and then Great Britain, France, and ultimately the United States in the west. And with this victory in the east, now Germany could concentrate all its forces in the west and try to break through, which they did in the Ludendorff offensives of the late spring and summer of 1918 to great success. Germans thought, this is our moment. Finally, after these nearly 4 years of war, we're finally going to win this war. And that those offensives ground down in the late summer and fall of 1918. But it was not fully clear to Germans that they were losing to the extent that they were going to lose the First World War. And so this... I teach an entire class on the First World War at Carleton This is a very complicated history, of course, the First World War in general and its final denouement. But the sort of general feeling among many Germans in that late fall of 1918 was we have not lost this war. Our troops are not in Germany. We have not been defeated on the battlefield. It was, in fact, the civilian leadership that stabbed the army in the back. Had it not been for this loss of political will at home and also kind of the societal bonds, we could have won this war. So there was this shock and disbelief that, you know, arguably never really went away at the end of the First World War and in the aftermath. Similarly, there were the peace treaty that resulted from the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, was one that Germans had no say in negotiating. This was decided upon by the Allies in Paris, in the outskirts of Paris, of course, in the Treaty of Versailles, where the treaty was ultimately signed. Negotiated, it was signed elsewhere, but the Allies had imposed this treaty on Germans, who did not have a say in it. And Germans felt like that this treaty was extremely harsh, unfairly harsh. And the kind of key clause in the Treaty of Versailles was that the Germans were forced to accept that they had caused the First World War, that they were to blame for the outbreak of the First World War. And as a result of causing the First World War, they were forced to pay reparations, to suffer territorial losses, to accept numerous infringements on their sovereignty. And this was seen as the humiliation at Versailles for Germans, a great frustration and outrage all across Germany that this treaty had been imposed upon them and that they were ultimately forced to sign what was almost universally held in Germany to be an unfair treaty. So we have a very different context in 1918, 1919 than we do in 1945, right? In the aftermath of the First World War, many Germans could not believe they had lost the war, thought they could have won the war had things just been slightly different, and that they should not have been forced to sign an extremely unfair treaty from the perspective of many Germans, okay? Many Germans, you know, this never really went away, this feeling of frustration and anger about the First World War. And of course, this was a major reason for the rise of the Nazi Party, Hitler, who relentlessly fulminated against the Treaty of Versailles and said, you know, give us a chance and we will overturn it. And there are, of course, many other reasons that Hitler came to power, but this was certainly an important one. The end of the Second World War, the situation is very different. Germany has clearly lost the war. It fought to the bitter end, and the Allies were forced at great cost to defeat German military forces and, you know, march their way through Germany towards Berlin. So there was this widespread acceptance among Germans that, yes, they had lost the war. There's no doubt about it. Also, a major difference was that there was an acknowledgement that Germany had done many terrible things in the Second World War. And this is another complicated issue that I can't go into in the context of this talk. But there was this sense that, okay, yes, it was war. Germans did many terrible things in war because everybody does terrible things in war, but there was this general sense that Germany had done some particularly terrible things, and because of that, deserved some kind of punishment, that this occupation that was going to happen because Germany had clearly lost the war, Germans were going to have to accept infringements on their sovereignty and suffer some kinds of penalties. Okay, so just a bit of a sense of the differences between the First and Second World War. And I might as well also throw in here the sense that the Allies at the Second World and the aftermath of the Second World War are different from the Allies at the end of the First World War. The notable addition here, of course, is the Soviet Union, who is a major player, along with the United States, of course, in the discussions around what to do about Germany in the aftermath of the Second World War. Germany is not there. Russia is not there at the end of the First World War in any meaningful way at all. So the United States is dealing with a different set of allies, especially the Soviet Union in 1945, that it wasn't dealing with in 1918-1919. Okay, so you see this map here on the screen. I'll show you one that's a little bit more legible, but just to kind of set some of the groundwork here for what we're talking about when we're talking about the American occupation of Germany. I hope you can read this map here. I imagine all of you can speak German. If not, this is something that's easily translatable. So the American zone, of course, is the blue here. You see in mostly the southern part of Germany. You see also the British occupation zone and the French occupation zone. The French occupation zone, the province of Rhineland-Pfalz, it was in this area that the Americans had their occupation zone in the aftermath of World War I. So the exhibit in the first slide talks about George Marshall, who I'll talk about briefly in the context of the Marshall Plan. He was there in 1919-1920 as I believe he was a soldier or maybe a young officer at that time, involved in the American occupation of Germany, but not in the same area. So just a kind of interesting historical note here. Obviously, the red part of the map here is the Soviet Union. And if you can see here, the different darker yellow color on the map, those are territories that Germany in its 1937 borders lost to Poland. And you can see in the upper right-hand corner, this province of East Prussia divided between the Soviet Union in the north that was given to the Russian province and the southern part of East Prussia given to Poland. Also of some note here, though not in the scope of the talk, as you can see, Austria also was occupied by the four powers. Vienna, similar to Berlin, had four sectors. So also the capital city of Austria was divided. And just as another interesting historical footnote, those four powers, the French, the British, the Americans, and the Soviets, were able to come to an agreement over Austria and withdrew their troops in 1955. Austria became a fully sovereign country, unified. There wasn't a West Austria and an East Austria in the Cold War. There was a unified Austria. So the occupying powers were able to make a deal on Austria. Obviously, the stakes are somewhat different. Austria, a country of 9-ish million people, Germany with somewhere around 70 million people, so a industrial powerhouse with a much larger population. The stakes are much higher, but interesting to note. Here's another map that's a little bit more legible for the division of Germany, showing you also how Berlin was divided. So these discussions about what to do about Germany, how to handle Germany in the aftermath of the Second World War, these were hammered out, at least the broad outlines, at a series of meetings during the Second World War in Tehran in 1943, in Yalta in early 1945, in Potsdam, the sort of big one right after the end of the war. That tries to sketch out both the broad outlines and come to some agreements for how the Allies, including the United States, are to go about this occupation regime. The four powers, so France initially wasn't at the table and then was added late in the war as a fourth occupier of Germany. The original plan was that they should all coordinate their actions through a single unit, the Allied Control Council, and that all agreements, all decisions rather, should be made by consensus, that they should all agree on what's going to happen, you know, on the ground as to how the administration of Germany should go forward. Now, within each occupation zone, each occupying power has the say, but the kind of broad policy is supposed to be agreed upon by all of the powers. There are, I'm going to talk about a little bit more about the kind of breakdown in the system in greater detail in the context of my last section of my talk when I'm talking about the intensifying Cold War. But just to highlight some of the kind of complications here, the Americans and the British are able to coordinate policy pretty seamlessly, and they kind of come to a series of agreements and in effect merge their occupation zones in the course of 1946. And the resulting Bizonia, as it was called, comes into being in early 1947. The French are a bit more recalcitrant. They often look to the Soviet Union to sort of help them with their desires. The French, for obvious historical reasons, really want to have a very strict, perhaps harsh regime towards the Germans, make sure that the Germans are never able to invade France again. Of course, the memory of the First and Second World Wars are extremely fresh, but ultimately the French also coordinate their policy with the British and Americans, and Trizonia emerges in the following year, which lays the groundwork for what will become West Germany. Again, a story I'll get more into later in the talk. So just thinking about the this occupation, it continues in its formal sense through 1955, when the Deutschlandvertrag, the general treaty, enters into force, which gives back Germany, well, at this point, West Germany, nearly full sovereignty, and ends the kind of occupation regime as we know it, as it materialized in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. Things had changed with the formation of West Germany in May of 1949. Military governors were replaced by civilian high commissioners and the like, but the official occupation ends in 1955, though, of course, troops remain in Germany, and Germany does have some, West Germany does have some limitations on its sovereignty. So to kind of back out just a little bit, to think about this question, what to do with Germany? This, of course, confronted all of the Allies from the moment war was declared, and each thought, you know, they would come out on top and win. How are they going to handle this country that had launched a second world war, right? The sense was, well, maybe Germany didn't cause the First World War, but certainly bore much of the blame for the First World War, and certainly bears blame for the Second World War. How are we going to handle this country? And in the sort of ideas that were informing all of the Allies, in particular the Americans, were the so-called five Ds. So we have demilitarization, decartelization, decentralization, democratization, and then, of course, denazification. I'll just talk briefly about these. One that's not in there is deindustrialization, though this was entertained as a potential D in the mix in the Morgenthau Plan. The Americans were considering the idea that they would try to kind of return Germany to a largely agricultural society, and in that way make sure that Germany never again threatened the security of Europe. But the decision was made not to do that, that Germany needed to be able to support itself. And then increasingly in the context of the Cold War, the desire was the main Western part of Germany would be an ally of the Western powers in this cold conflict with the Soviet Union. Demilitarization, quite obvious. Germany should not have the ability to prosecute a war like this and should not have troop levels that it had previously. Decartelization, the sense of the Allies was German industry was highly concentrated in very large corporations that worked together in close concert, and power was concentrated in various sectors of industry, which then made it easier for the Nazis to control and direct that industry towards obviously ill ends. And so the idea was to break up these large industrial concerns and not again allow the possibility for industrial economic power to be concentrated as had been the case before 1945. Decentralization, clearly the Nazis did centralize their regime in many ways. The Allies wanted that to not happen again. So in the occupation regime, and then in the basic law of the Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany, and also in East Germany, there was a reassigning of political power out to the provinces so that Germany would not be as centralized as had been the case before 1945. Fourth D, democratization, right? Trying to introduce Western-style liberal democracy to Germany. This is a kind of complicated process. The Americans, you know, in their numerous anecdotes where the Americans did allow local elections in the aftermath of the Second World War, and then the townspeople of a town elected a former important Nazi to be mayor. So, you know, what do you do here? Do you accept the results of democracy, or do you anti-democratically install a figure who believes in democratic values? For Germans, democracy had then, in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, a very different connotation than certainly it does now. It was associated with the Weimar system from 1919 to 1933, a time of political instability and chaos and economic problems, from the hyperinflation of the early 1920s to the Great Depression of the early 1930s. So the Weimar system, which was a democratic system, was not seen particularly favorably by many Germans. So this desire to democratize Germany, while perhaps seeming obvious to outside eyes, wasn't necessarily so for many Germans. The fifth and most important D, denazification. So this took a number of forms, and I'm going to again focus on the American case here, in concert with its allies, but thinking more about the American case. The highest profile example of denazification was, of course, the Nuremberg trials, which focused on high-ranking Nazis and was a joint effort by the four major allies to put war criminals on trial and punish them, showing the German people that their leaders had done terrible things and they were going to be punished for it. One could offer a whole class on the Nuremberg trials, of course, very complicated, but kind of one of the centerpiece moments of the denazification process. Again, all the allies had agreed that they would denazify. All of them did it in somewhat different ways. The Western allies, a bit more similar than what the Soviet Union did. So all had agreed that they would undertake this process to try to root out Nazism from German society. The Soviet Union, just as a comparative case here, saw this rather differently than the other three powers, saw Nazism as connected to economic power, and thought by significant restructuring of the economic system, dividing up large land holdings, taking away the heavy industry, the coal mines from the hands of capitalists, of the bourgeoisie, as the Soviet Union would put it, of those wealthy members of German society, and nationalizing it, taking it over. This was the way to denazify. For the Americans and the other Western allies, but especially the Americans, it was seen as a much more kind of individual and personal process, that those who were involved with the Nazi regime either needed to be punished or had to go through some kind of re-education process, or perhaps both. And this is an enormous undertaking. If we think about how many Germans had been very closely involved with the Nazi regime, the question is, how do you denazify so many people? So around 8.5 million Germans, about 10% of the population, were Nazi Party members, right? So closely linked to the regime. They're members of the party that had ruled Germany for these 12 years and conducted so many crimes in Germany and in Europe. But even beyond that, there were many tens of millions of Germans who had joined Nazi-affiliated organizations. The German Labor Front had 25 million members, the National Socialist People's Welfare Organization, 17 million members. There's League of German Women, of course, the Hitler's Youth, the Doctors League, Leagues for Every Profession. As many as 45 million Germans were linked to the Nazi Party through these various organizations. So how do you denazify all of these people, right? How are you going to investigate them? What is the kind of rubric or the guidelines for deciding how guilty somebody is, whether they should be punished for it in some way, how they should be punished, whether they should go through some kind of re-education? So just a massive project here. Eisenhower himself thought this process would take something like 50 years in order to do it thoroughly. So Germans who were closely involved with the Nazis were forced to answer a series of questions, initially this Fragebogen, then in a kind of reorganization of the process, a Meldebogen, where they were supposed to outline their connection to the Nazi regime and any actions that they had done in concert with the Nazi regime. And immediately this just becomes a bureaucratic nightmare, right? So the Germans are filling this out in German. The Americans have to get translators so that their personnel can try to figure out what's being said here. You know, we're at the dawn of the computer age. All of this is on paper. I mean, we just have these massive backlogs, you know, of millions of forms of Germans to decide their level of guilt and how to handle this. What kind of emerges for at this moment are a set of categories that you can see here from somebody who is entlastete, someone who is seen as only a minor Nazi or not someone who bears significant responsibility, to, as you can read here, those who were followers, minor offenders, offenders of some significance, and then major offenders. And deciding who gets put in what basket and the punishment is a major and huge process. So immediately there's this major backlog in how to handle this at a time of significant social unrest is going far, but a major difficulty in the aftermath of the First World War. There's not enough food for everybody. People are on the move. There's the expellees from the territories taken over by Poland, Czechoslovakia, and the Soviet Union who are flowing into Germany. You have people moving from Eastern Germany, the Soviet zone west. I mean, all kinds of complicated chaos here. And this is happening also as the Cold War is intensifying. Germans want to kind of move on from this process. The Americans are increasingly receptive. They want the Germans on their side in what's looking like a major clash with the Soviet Union. The Americans in 1946 already turn over much of the responsibility for denazification to the Germans themselves, who are perhaps unsurprisingly less rigorous in their evaluation of other Germans. And the process kind of peters out in the late 1940s and early 1950s. Many historians have looked back on this as a kind of missed moment, that many former Nazis and former important Nazis who would be in the, you know, offenders or major offenders category were allowed to get off with fairly little sanction. They got their, as the joke went the day, their Persilscheine, Persil, the Waschmittel, the washing machine powder, the certificate telling them that they've now been, you know, scrubbed clean and they can move on with their lives, even though they were complicit or heavily implicated in the Nazi regime. So there's been a lot of criticism as of denazification in the American sector as a kind of missed opportunity. But that's something that certainly can be debated. Okay, The Americans, in the context of the Cold War, as I mentioned with denazification, are changing their policy. They're reorienting from seeing the Germans as a threat that needs to be contained and held down, and seeing increasingly West Germans as potential allies in the struggle to come against the Soviet Union. And just thinking about the Cold War, again here through a German prism, but also thinking more broadly, there is still vigorous debate about the origins of the Cold War. Who should be blamed for the Cold War? Was it inevitable? I have debates with my students based on the literature of a variety of different historians. There are different schools that would assign responsibility for the Cold War in various ways. And just to give you, you know, the vaguest of outlines of this, highlighting some of the German elements here in just a few minutes, if we think to the end of the Second World War, the Soviet Union suffered mightily, more than 20 million casualties in the Second World War. It was on the Eastern Front that the fighting was the most fierce and brutal. Stalin, he was paranoid to some extent, but not without cause. He wanted to secure a cordon of friendly states in Eastern Europe, and this had been kind of largely agreed upon, not the details, but that the Soviet Union should have friendly states on its Western borders with Germany to prevent or to help mitigate any threat coming from Germany in the future, was something that Churchill and Roosevelt certainly understood. Stalin felt very mistrustful towards the Allies. In the Second World War, he'd been constantly pleading for a second front to help relieve the pressure on the Soviet Union on the Eastern Front with Nazi Germany, and Churchill and Roosevelt kept putting him off. We're not ready to do this. We're distracted by what's going on in Asia. You know, these are all, of course, important considerations. But from the perspective of Stalin, it seemed like the Western Allies were letting the Nazi juggernaut bleed the Soviet Union dry. We're not opening that second front. I mean, Italy finally in 1943, and then France in 1944. So there was a great deal of suspicion from Stalin even before the war was over. Of course, the United States was very suspicious of Stalin, and with good cause as well. Stalin was, not a, for all the propaganda in the Second World War of Uncle Joe with his pipe, he was a very brutal dictator, wanted to extend Soviet power. You know, the questions are, that historians debate, was how far was Stalin going or willing to push it at this time? Could there have been some kind of, if not more collaborative approach between the Western powers and the Soviet Union, you know, something that wouldn't turn into the Cold War as we know it? I would point, as many scholars do, to kind of key elements in the heating up of this Cold War. And it's often the Western allies who are taking what could be perceived as provocative actions. By the same token, the justification would be these seemingly preventative actions are taken because the threat of the Soviet Union is real and the United States needs to secure its interest in the face of an expansionist Soviet Union. That is, of course, the thought here. So one key element in the intensifying Cold War is this debate over reparations. So it had been agreed in discussions in the late stages of the war and then confirmed at Potsdam that each occupying power could take reparations from its zone. That is, it could take tax the German people, take factories or some portion of what's produced in factories as reparations for the costs that they had incurred in the Second World War. The one exception here was the Soviet Union. There was an acknowledgement that the Soviet Union had suffered significantly more than the other countries, and the Soviet Union was supposed to get get reparations, not only from its zone, from what would become East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, but was also supposed to get reparations from the Western zones. It was in the West that the real industrial power of Germany lay, in the Ruhrgebiet, coal, the Rhineland, these areas of industrial production. The Soviet Union was supposed to get reparations from those areas. Those were agreed upon in 1944 and 1945. In 1946, the Americans and British felt that that was just not possible. Germany was not able to feed itself, especially from the perspective of Great Britain. All kinds of aid and food was given to the Germans to just to keep sort of the minimal caloric requirements there for Germans. And so to send reparations, send money or material or products to the Soviet Union from their occupation zones at a time when the Germans can't support themselves and the British or American taxpayers are sending aid to the Germans was just something that the Americans and the British felt they could not do. And they did not allow Stalin then to take the promised reparations from Western Germany, which of course enraged and infuriated Stalin. He felt that this was an agreement that had been broken. And so this Allied Control Council that I mentioned briefly at the beginning, that was supposed to manage the administration of Germany and decide how things were supposed to proceed, begins to grind down. The French, the British, and the Americans are not agreeing with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is getting increasingly frustrated, seeking alternative ways to get its interests met. The Soviets, of course, see Bizonia, the Americans and British merging their zones, then Trizonia. They see West Germany coming into being, which it does in May of 1949. East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, isn't founded until October of 1949 in reaction to what happens in the West first. And of course, one of the initiatives that the Americans are undertaking here, as you see on this slide, is the Marshall Plan. Here, the slide to the left, you'll see also in the exhibit at the GAI currently. The Americans are offering aid, but aid with strings attached. I mean, unsurprisingly, you have to buy American products. If you accept aid, you have to follow certain American capitalist requirements for how that's going to be done. The Americans offer it to countries in the Soviet bloc, who Stalin forces them to turn this down, sees this as an attempt by the Americans to increase their influence in Europe, further ratcheting up tensions. The Americans offer this aid to West Germany, also to East Germany, but the East Germans are not allowed to accept it by Stalin. The West Germans do. This is part of the economic reorganization of the Western zones that culminate in a currency reform. Again, much more detail could be given about the steps in this process, but the Western allies, without consulting the Soviet Union, decide to introduce a new currency in the Western zones, and crucially, also in West Berlin. The Soviets feel that this is unjust, it's not fair, they haven't been consulted. And as a result, this is sort of the straw that breaks the proverbial camel's back, they blockade Berlin. They try to get the Western allies to back down through this very extreme measure, not allowing American, British, and French transport across land, across the roads or rail into Berlin that had never been specified in the agreements at the end of the Second World War. The Soviets had been allowing the Americans to transport and British to transport supplies to their sectors of West Berlin, but that had not been codified anywhere. So the Soviets cut off that access, trying to, in a sense, starve West Berlin to force the Americans' hand to back down and acknowledge Soviet demands in a variety of areas. And of course, as is well known, the Americans and British and French organized this airlift, right? The Soviet Union could theoretically have shot down these airplanes, but they did not. And this huge undertaking is staged for almost a year in 1948 and 1949. Stalin ultimately backs down. He recognizes that he has lost this battle in the larger Cold War. But this if the Cold War is not officially underway at this point, it is definitely underway at this point. West Germany joins NATO in 1949, and the Cold War divide that we know about is truly in effect at this point. So Germany, of course, plays a major role in the intensifying of the Cold War. There are other areas of the world as well, but ground zero, as it were, is Berlin. And it is the kind of difficulties over the administration of Germany. These various occupation zones help to create this scenario of a Cold War. So I think I'm basically out of time. I've gone slightly over, I think. So I will stop here. I'll stop sharing my screen here. And I would welcome any questions you might have. Thank you again for listening. So I see in the chat here, okay. Dolchstoß, yeah, right. The stab in the back, someone wrote early in my lecture, this sense that the German military had been stabbed in the back by civilian leaders. The Nazis very effectively painted the civilian leaders who had stabbed the military in the back at the end of the First World War as Jewish, right? They were Jewish leaders of the kind of centrist and left-wing parties that had ruined the mighty German military and not enabled them to prosecute the First World War. That kind of legend was not the case. At the end of the Second World War, everyone knew that Germany had fought with everything it had and more, and had lost that war. Question from Melanie Christensen about Spandau Prison. Yeah, the sharing of the guarding between the Allies and the administration. That's a really interesting question. Great question, and one that unfortunately I don't know enough about to talk about with any authority. But that's a great question. Yeah, sorry, I can't answer that one. Can I comment on how the easing of denazification in the 1950s reverberates in German politics today? That is an excellent question. Melanie, you'll write about Spandau in your blog. Okay, send me the link and I look forward to reading it. How denazification resonates in German politics today. So we just had here at Carleton, I don't know if I have the book handy here, but I don't have it handy, but we just had a speaker talk about the lessons of the German kind of confrontation with Nazism, potential lessons for Americans. It's called Learning from the Germans. Kind of very interesting book, kind of very problematic, comparing two very different cases, but she's focused on the process of confronting the past. So the kind of story that she tells, that I agree the broad outlines are, Germans after World War II, they just want to put the Nazi period behind them. They want to forget the Nazi era. They don't want to go through this denazification process. They just want to put it away. And I'm talking about West Germany here. It's a different context in East Germany. So there's really a lot of pressure from the German population to just forget it. Hitler was really the only Nazi, and we were all forced to do what we did during those 12 years of National Socialism. There is a reckoning with that begins, as many of you may know, with the 1968 generation, the kind of younger people asking their parents, what did you do during the Second World War? What was your involvement? And that kind of launches this process, this examination of the Nazi period that continues, I would say still today. The kind of generation of 1968, it's many of those people are the people in power in Germany, right? They're now aging out of power, but that 1968 generation, those people born in the late 1940s, are in their 60s and 70s today, are the ones who went through these debates, went through this societal self-examination, did this process of one of these great long German words of Vergangenheitsbewältigung or Vergangenheitsaufarbeitung, this kind of confrontation, working through the past, confrontation of the past. How does it reverberate in German politics today? I think there, you know, this rise of the populist right, the AfD, the Alternative for Germany, which is the third largest party in Germany currently, they feel that Germany went too far in this confrontation with kind of the Nazi past, and really we should, it was just a few people and we should not be talking about it anymore. I would say for the broad kind of middle, from the, you know, center left through the center right of German politics, there is this sense that Germany did need to be denazified in the sense of, you know, kind of re-education, confronting the past, working through that past. You know, what could be more symbolic than in the aftermath of the reunification of Germany, there is this decision to put a memorial for the murdered Jews of Europe right in the center of Germany, of the new capital to be. So this kind of having worked through the past, atoning for the past, I think is something that most Germans, there's a broad consensus that that was correct and right, and that Germany did need to denazify, didn't do it effectively enough in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, but has done it in a fairly effective way starting in the 1960s, you know, really through to today. So thank you, Jake. I hope that answers your questions. Guilford Hartley, is there a rhythm of ups and downs over the centuries from the 30 Years' War through the Napoleonic era through the Franco-Prussian War that could give perspective on the events of the 20th century? Wow, that's a huge question. Yes. You know, I say when a class I teach here at Carleton is modern Germany, which I talk about, you know, Germany in the 19th and 20th centuries. And I always start off with the first line of Thomas Nipperdey, one of the, you know, kind of towering German historians, historian of Germany and is German. He starts off his magisterial history of Germany with, "In the beginning was Napoleon." And what he means there is, you know, what really drives kind of German nationalism and German policy in many ways is a reaction to France. France, the hegemon of the, you know, 17th and 18th centuries, France, which for various historical reasons consolidated as a coherent state and increasingly a coherent nation state, a threat to Germany in the 19th and 20th centuries. German nationalism is in many ways a reaction to French hegemony in Europe. So if I, you know, I don't know enough to sort of go all the way back to the 30 Years' War, but if I take the, you know, the later events that you're evoking, the Napoleonic era, the Franco-Prussian War, thinking of the First World War, it is this conflict between France and Germany. And of course, there's a lot more going on, but at the core of kind of German history and European history is this Franco-German conflict. And the final resolution of this in the aftermath of the Second World War, that you had key figures, Konrad Adenauer as one of them, and his counterparts in France, who are able to, you know, in a spirit of reconciliation, come together and think about both their countries and Europe more broadly, and how to make war, as it happened so often in the last 150 years, to put that as something that is just unable to ever happen again. We're going to integrate key aspects of our economy. We're going to bind ourselves together in these multinational organizations, in something like NATO, in the European Economic Community as it emerges in the 1950s through the 1970s in the Europe today. I would say, you know, this is kind of this core historical conflict slash, you know, recurring element is Franco-German conflict, and then endlich, finally overcoming that those misunderstandings or disagreements or the like. Thank you, Aaron, for putting up Susan Neiman's book, Learning from the Germans. That's exactly what I was talking about. She appeared with us, and I'll look forward to seeing her with you guys in a few months. From Michael Kowalska, after U.S. soldiers liberated some of the concentration camps, how did German civilians react to the reality that was taking place inside the camps regarding the horrific events? That is a great question, and that actually, Susan Neiman addresses this in part in her book. There, So her thesis is, and it's fresh in my mind because she just appeared with us, and I think this is a kind of compelling part of the book, is many Germans, it didn't sink in what they were seeing. Many Germans in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War kind of chalked that up to it was war, and war was brutal, and we did brutal things, and that was bad, but brutal things were done to us as well. I mean, think of what Germany suffered in the Second World War, both the fighting as well as then Allied bombing of German cities, aerial bombing, and then of course, Germany being defeated and occupied by the Allied forces. There was this sense that Germans saw themselves as victims just as much as everybody else at that time. And one of the kind of extraordinary things that Susan Neiman identifies in her book is that Germans still saw themselves as victims, but were able eventually, after many decades and much work, both grassroots and from above, to acknowledge that others were victims as well, and more victims. They were victimized more by Germans, and a kind of broader acceptance of that and a societal understanding of that helped Germany to confront its past, overcome its past, and, you know, become the democratic country that it is today. So I'm branching off from your question, your excellent question, Michael, but the many German civilians just kind of like, you know, turned away. They didn't want to see what was going on in the camps. And they tried to say, oh, this was, you know, this was either part of war, a terrible thing, or this was something that was done by a few rogue elements of the Nazi regime and not something that Germans need to have responsibility for. Running out of time here, but Ron Campbell has a question on the Nazi movements today in Germany and the USA. So, you know, I probably don't know any more, and potentially even less than you, Ron, or anyone else about the Nazi movements today in Germany. I know what I, you know, kind of see on the news and read in the newspapers. In Germany, there has been this kind of, how should I put it, this legitimation of kind of far right-wing beliefs that before would have been outside the pale, that it would have not been kind of part of political discourse. This is this party that I mentioned, the Alternative for Germany, this kind of right-wing populist party in Germany, which does kind of play with Nazi tropes and is drawn on kind of neo-Nazi organizations in Germany, and it's kind of like allowed this discourse into the public sphere in a way that it wasn't before. Some of its leaders have made kind of comments praising certain elements of Nazism or denigrating those who, you know, would stand up to fascism then and today. I would say this movement, even though it gets in the middle teens of the vote and has gotten, I think, is its highest percentage of the vote in a regional election. A state election is something in the low 30s. It's still, no other parties are willing to form a coalition with it. It's seen as outside of the pale. You know, we all wonder what's happening with populist movements all throughout the modern world, the contemporary world. In Germany, it's there as well. I would say that movement in Germany, again, on a national level, hasn't gotten more than, you know, 14-15% of the vote so far. If we compare it to, say, the Front National in France or in other countries, support for similar right-wing parties is much higher, depending on who you classify as part of those parties. So it's a worrying sign that the AfD is getting so much support. However, it is relatively low and lower than other neighboring countries. So that would be my comment on, you know, they're not Nazi, but they do draw on some Nazi themes, and they are this considered a far right party in the European political context. Thank you so much for joining me tonight, and thank you for the excellent questions. I hope to see you in person at a GAI event sometime, you know, who knows, but maybe next fall we'll be back to some semblance of normalcy. And yes, Thank you.
Thank you so much, David. We hope to see you again soon. We appreciate it.